dear listener, for tuning in to Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
We're back on Panopticon Podcast, and we're with Ben, and part two of the Middle East / U.S. foreign policy show. But I guess we're going to get in the next hour into your experiences in Palestine.
With pleasure.
Okay, so let's go there. So you're in Albuquerque.
Yeah.
And you're doing activist work.
Yeah.
And what happens?
Okay, well, I'm in Albuquerque doing activist work. The war starts in March. Which is to say the Iraq invasion. And I felt the need, personally, to take my activism to the next level, because I just felt...
So I think it's a UFO landing.
There's a UFO coming. It's the Mossad.
The Mossad UFO.
I felt the need to get involved more than I was as a student. And I felt the need, and I wasn't a traditional student, you know, I was in my like mid to late 20s at this time. So I wasn't just content with like campus demos and stuff, you know, because as far as I felt, you know, the world was exploding, we were on the wrong side of it, in Palestine and in Iraq. It was heady times, as you recall, you know, for anybody that was alive then or paying attention or young then. And I had become so interested in the Palestinian issue at this point, I began to learn about a group, as I mentioned earlier, called the International Solidarity Movement. I described them a little bit in the previous episode. And the day before, I believe, the war started, or certainly in the days leading up to the actual invasion, a young American girl called Rachel Corey was killed in Rafah, Palestinian city in Gaza, in the service while acting as a, you know, as a volunteer in the International Solidarity Movement.
A human shield.
She was at that time a human shield, among other things she was doing, yeah. But she was killed, you know, while human shielding a house that was being demolished by the Israeli military to create some sort of buffer zone around the border or the wall or something. And she was standing in front of a house. The house belonged to friends of hers, Palestinian family, a couple of families. They live in family compounds, extended family compounds over there for the most part.
Yeah.
And refusing to move as this Israeli military bulldozer was trying to demolish the house. And, you know, I think probably a lot of your listeners have probably heard this story, but anyway, she was standing there with a bullhorn and a bright orange vest. They knew she was there. Obviously, their defense after the fact was that they didn't, but that's, you know, made laughably ridiculous by photo evidence and everything. I mean, certainly they knew she was there.
Right.
You know, and as the day went on, they got tired of waiting. At some point, they ran her over with this big-ass Caterpillar bulldozer, boycott Caterpillar, because they make specially designed tractors and bulldozers for the Israeli military, special specifications, you know, that are designed to crush Palestinian homes. And there's a good boycott of them going on. Check it out online. Anyway, she was run over by the bulldozer. It drug the shovel over her again. Her fellow volunteers and some Palestinian friends ran over to her. And she was, like, buried in the dirt. Pretty gruesome scene, actually. And she kind of whispered, "I think my back is broken."
Yeah.
And as far as anybody knows, those were her last words. She arrived in the hospital in Gaza, in a Palestinian hospital, in the words of the attending physician, arrived, quote, as a dead body. So she was killed while human shielding in the ISM. The actions that the IDF, I'll refer to them for the rest of the time as IDF, as Israeli Defense Forces, which is to say the Israeli military in its various capacities. The IDF's actions in terms of these housing demolitions, along with most of the things they do in the occupied territories, or really everything they do, because they shouldn't be there at all, actions are illegal under international law. Rachel Corrie was on the right side of international law. She was, by certainly in my opinion, on the right side of moral law, the laws of humanity and kindness and everything else. So she died and became not in the beginning very well known because the war started, right? Like a couple days later, or maybe even like the next day, I want to say. And that news got drowned out, you know, like some American hippie girl got killed trying to stick up for the Arabs kind of thing. Well, compare that news cycle to, you know, the beginning of us invading Iraq.
Right.
As time went by, her story became a lot more well-known, and it is today fairly well-known. You know, I think even in mainstream circles, people might have some passing knowledge of her. And certainly in any kind of progressive activist circles in the States, she's very well-known. And she's very well-known in Palestine, I would add, as well, and respected and appreciated. Also, that week, a young British man called Tom Herndahl was shot in the head by an Israeli military sniper in the act of human shielding several children who had been caught in the crossfire. He was also wearing the orange vest that the IDF knew were used by international peacekeeper activists like the ISM, who were never a violent threat in any way, give me a break. Never took part in anything even remotely violent. Simply human shields. So this guy was assassinated, you know. And he went into a coma and died like 8 months later in Britain, never regained consciousness. He was a young guy, he was like 21, 22 years old. I should add that Rachel Corrie, I believe, was from Olympia, Washington, and also pretty young, early 20s.
Yeah, there was just recently a Democracy Now! Kind of tribute to her.
Right, right, because of trial.
Just a couple weeks ago.
Right, yeah. Right. Her parents have got a civil suit against the Israeli military.
Right, so we should honor that.
Indeed, indeed.
For sure.
Hell of a woman, and she's, like I said, well-regarded in Palestine. Anyway,
so
her
where
death...
this places you...
This places me as a... This affected me in that her death and her courage... The moment I, well, maybe not the moment I first heard about it, but within days of first hearing about it, and as it became bigger news on Democracy Now! And I researched it on the internet, made me decide I'm going to go to ISM, and I'm gonna try to take her place in some small, humble way, and I hope a lot of other people do too. And the Israeli military can't just, you know, chase everybody away and have us leave these relatively voiceless people on an international scale, voiceless people alone to just be treated like animals, you know, and that I'm going to go over there and do what she was doing, and I hope hundreds or thousands of other people do the same,
right.
And we're not going to leave these people just all alone in this horrible situation that we, in fact, fund, you know. So, I did. I was luckily pretty well placed in the activist community there, started making phone calls about doing fundraisers and stuff. I had no money, you know, I was living hand to mouth as a, you know, university student doing construction on the weekends or painting people's houses or stuff, whatever. Didn't have any money. All the money I took on my first trip to Palestine was fundraised by the activist community there in Albuquerque. And I, thanks, if you're listening, appreciate it. There were some people that really came through for me. We had like a spaghetti dinner. We had various things. We had buckets out at various stores where people could drop in their change and this was, you know, March of 2003, and by August of 2003, I was able to buy my plane ticket. I had raised just enough money to do it, you know, and I didn't have any extra money, you know.
This is a ticket from Albuquerque to...
Tel Aviv. Albuquerque to Tel Aviv, a pretty expensive ticket, so I was lucky to... I mean, it took a lot of hard work, but I had a lot of great friends that helped me out with it, you know, really helped me out with it, like maybe... dozens and dozens of hours each over the course of those 3 or 4 months of helping me fundraise. And I was lucky. It's a great activist community. I miss them now, and I hope they're all doing well if they're out there. Anyway, I got my, you know, I probably got like $3,000 together, something like that, and $1,200 of that went into the airfare. I flew out, ironically, just by coincidence, flew out on September 11th, 2003, from Albuquerque to Tel Aviv. Without a great deal of knowledge about what I was getting into in terms of the nuts and bolts the practical realities of what it was going to be like to get into the occupied territories and work with ISM. I mean, I had a pretty good knowledge of what was going on over there, but I didn't really know what to expect, and because ISM was not a welcome entity by the Israeli government, you couldn't really, you know, it all had to be like a secret, you know, like you had to have a story to get into the country.
Okay.
You couldn't be like, hey, I'm going to do ISM, you know, I'm going to go screw up your military operations in Jenin or whatever, you know.
Right.
They would turn your ass away. I mean, they are already pretty known for having really strict policies in terms of getting into Israel anyway. You know, obviously they have legitimate security concerns. They're checking for weapons, checking for bombs, they want to know everything. And legitimate security concerns, also the desire to keep people out who are going there to do things like ISM. Though nonviolent, are a pain in their ass, you know, and tell stories that they would rather not be told, and write articles that they would rather not be written, and things of that nature, you know.
Right.
So I got into Israel, luckily. I mean, I was interrogated for a couple hours in New Jersey before I even left my own country by some guy from the Shin Bet of the Mossad, who was interrogating me, an American citizen. He has a representative of the foreign government interrogating me in Newark, New Jersey, before I could even get on the plane, which I guess speaks to America's special relationship with Israel.
Right.
I don't think there's anybody else that could do that.
Right, right, right.
Couldn't imagine some guy from Nicaragua stopping you at LaGuardia and being like, hey, I need to ask you some questions,
right,
only about
right,
2 hours worth, you know.
Right.
So, I mean, they were on the lookout for ISM. ISM was becoming a real pain in their ass. They were getting a lot of bad publicity about having killed Rachel and Tom. And probably more importantly, all these ISM people, some of whom were like pretty accomplished journalists, some of whom were like me, just kind of ragtag activist kids, were writing articles and stuff that otherwise wouldn't have been getting out, you know, and telling the truth about how brutal it was. And maybe they didn't have like, you know, they couldn't get published in the New York Times or something, but, you know, their churches, their community groups, their activist communities, their moms and dads was hearing about it,
right,
and talking about it.
Right.
And that, you know, that is something in itself, you know. Better than nothing. So I get to Tel Aviv. I get interrogated a couple more hours. And I finally get to leave. I caught a bus to Jerusalem. I had the name of the hostel that you were supposed to go to and kind of quietly ask around about ISM.
Okay.
And it's a pretty intimidating process. You know, I was a pretty well-traveled guy. I wasn't, you know, like a teenager or anything. I was, you know, I was probably like 26 at the time. But still, a pretty intimidating process, all the interrogation. You really had to have your story together. I went under the guise of being like a Christian tourist, like a Christian fundamentalist tourist,
like
which made the most sense, like an evangelical,
right,
which made the most sense because, you know, they're obviously the kind of Americans that Israel is happy to have over there, but the timing was weird, you know, this was like the height of the Intifada.
Right.
It was like, this is a weird now, time for you to be visiting.
Time-wise, when is this?
This is, you know, early to mid-September of 2003.
Okay.
Right, so this is like, the Intifada is blowing up, you know, I mean, the first story on the news every night is always either Iraq or Palestine. There was a lot of suicide bombings, there was, like I described earlier, the invasion of the West Bank. I mean, it was essentially a war, you know, however one-sided. It was essentially a war environment. And so they're like, well, it's kind of a strange time to come see the holy sites there, buddy, you know, was their basic attitude. And they were pretty skeptical, but I had planned. Very, you know, when I put my mind to something, I tend to get it done. And every little thing in my luggage backed up my story. I had gone out and bought a Bible. I had letters from fake people in my congregation. And I don't have a congregation, I should mention. You know, I'm not a religious guy.
Right.
Everything. I was dressed like a nerd. I got my nerdy haircut. No offense, I'm not saying Christians are nerds or anything, but this is how I thought I could make myself believable. Because I was like a little punk rock kid, you know?
Yeah.
Everything I was wearing, every single thing. And the funny thing was, I was stuck with these horrible books. I had taken all these lame books for cover, because I knew they would search my luggage in great detail, and indeed they did.
Right.
So all my books backed up this horrible. So I was stuck with the worst books ever for this whole right. 3 month trip.
So they really do look at your books and shit.
Dude, they look at everything.
And they
like,
definitely.
If they're suspicious, if my grandma went, she wouldn't, you know, but, you know, you're a young guy. Yeah, they're very. Very, very careful. Like, nothing I've ever seen. You know?
Okay.
Yeah.
So you land in Tel Aviv.
Land in Tel Aviv.
Get out of the airport.
Zip down to Jerusalem on a bus. And then, you know, I'm kind of not sure what to do, but I know I need to go to this hostel and kind of quietly ask around, like I said, about ISM. So I did so, but you didn't know how to handle it, you know, like you knew that even being associated in any way with ISM was grounds for deportation.
And what is that?
And arrest. ISM is the International Solidarity Movement.
Right, I should say.
I'll refer to it as the acronym there, ISM. Being associated with them at all was grounds for instant arrest and deportation.
Okay.
You know, if not legally, in practice, that's what was going on.
Right.
And you know that there's probably, like, you know, sympathizers or spies or whatever, like, trying to bust up your ISM. You don't know exactly how deep it goes, how serious it is. So it was kind of nerve-wracking to go in there and kind of discreetly try to figure out what was what. You know?
Right, so you kind of mull your way in.
Right.
You get to Jerusalem.
Well, I find the guy I need to find. Guy named Hashim.
So you had like a contact in Jerusalem?
I had a place to go to find people that were in charge of ISM, that's where they hung out and that's where you went.
Okay.
But no, like, nobody to ask for specifically or anything, but...
Okay.
So I did so, and I got straightened out, and there was a training coming up that weekend. You have to do a training, a 2-day nonviolence training and orientation before you can go out into the field. I did that. That was in Beit Sahor, which is a little Palestinian city near Bethlehem.
Just as an aside, what is the nature of this nonviolent training?
Mm-hmm. I had done a lot of nonviolent trainings in the States. You know, before you go to a charge demo in the States, you would often do nonviolence trainings, which consist largely of how to react peacefully to violent confrontations, how to not get sucked into, like, a punching fight when you're there to spread peace, or how to trust-building exercises with your fellow activists, role-playing of, you know, because there's nothing that's really going to prepare for you for, like, a confrontation with, like, a pissed-off, scared Israeli army guy,
right,
you know, who had to leave his nice armored vehicle to come deal with you. Like, he's not happy about it. He doesn't know if somebody's going to take a pot shot at him. It's a really charged environment, you know, particularly at that time. So a lot of it was role-playing. A lot of it was general knowledge about what to expect. Who were the border guards as opposed to the actual army?
Right.
What was the difference?
Okay.
You know, what were your legal recourses when you were taken into custody at a demonstration? And part of it, I'll tell you right now, part of it was telling them who to call if you got killed.
Right.
I remember two people had been killed already, and a third, Brian Avery, had his face shot off, half of his face shot off. He's, like, permanently maimed. He's thankfully alive, I think, and doing fine. I don't know the guy, but, I mean, he's definitely damaged. Like, they blew off his jaw, half of his tongue.
Jesus,
it was a big deal, you know? So, I mean... It was a very real thing when they were like, yo, we hate to say it, but who do you want us to holler at if you don't have...
They want to make sure that you're not a fucking freak.
They're making sure that you have the right motivations, that you're not any kind of a Nazi or any weirdo or anything like that, or a saboteur.
Right, okay.
Or a provocateur or anything. Like, they're looking for real peace activists.
Right.
I did this little training. It was 2 days. I had a couple days to wait before doing the training. So I got to check out Jerusalem a little bit, and I also went down to Dehesha refugee camp, which is like in the Bethlehem area there, which is across the 67 lines in the occupied territories, but right near Jerusalem.
Okay.
You know, so I got to go there on a little tour of the refugee camp, see what conditions were like, and it was that's a pretty real experience, as you can imagine. I mean, it's pretty stark, it's pretty rough. And that's one of the better ones, because they're so close to the, you know, where the tourists go, that they actually get some visitors and some funding. They're not off in the, you know, further flung places in the West Bank where there's no help and there's no international exposure. So in Dehesha, I was lucky enough to meet some other young people, men and women, who were there trying to work in their community and survive this, you know, survive this occupation. And... the tour was fascinating because of the crowded nature of living in these camps, the unfairness of the fact that these people are still in these camps 60 years after. I mean, when you hear about Palestinian refugees, whether it be in Jordan, whether it be in Syria, whether it be in Lebanon, whether it be in the occupied territories or any number of other places, these are people that were kicked out of their homes during the war of 1948, in which the State of Israel came to exist.
Right.
So when you're there in 2003, these people's granddads might have been born in the camps, or they might remember the expulsion.
Right.
So in all those years, things have gotten really not much better and probably worse, particularly through the 80s and 90s, things got worse. The occupation became a lot more heavy-handed. And, you know, it was just, it was an amazing experience to talk to these people who had grown up like that. The people who I had grown up watching on the news, you know, these Palestinian kids that are seen all over the world, like throwing rocks or getting beat down by soldiers or whatever they're doing. There you were, sitting in their tiny little living rooms in their little concrete black homes. And anyway, I didn't spend much time in Dehesha, but I would recommend it to anybody who's there. It's probably the easiest camp to visit if you're, you know, not feeling too, you know, too bold or whatever. You can go there safely and have a nice tour and still get a very real idea of what's going on there. Dehesha Refugee Camp, it's called. So then, we have our training in a little town called Beit Sahor, which is also in the occupied territories, but right over the line from Jerusalem. Not far. So we did our training, as I mentioned, and from there I went. You could kind of pick, but also were guided a little bit into where you might go based on what that particular ISM group needed. So let me explain that ISM had groups in, at the time, it was harder for them to get people into Gaza because, you know, Gaza is like an encircled prison, you know, so there's not, it's, you can't really sneak in, you know, and if you didn't have some rock solid reason, like UN permission, and even that might be a stretch, the Israelis weren't going to let you in. And they certainly didn't want more people in there going and writing articles and everything like that, getting in the way.
How did you get in?
Well, I didn't. We couldn't. That wasn't one of our options. We were all headed to various places in the West Bank. And I was one of the few people that was going to be there, like, long term. Most people could only go for a week or two or three because they had real jobs or whatever. I was there for the full 3 months. So they sent me, they asked for volunteers to go to Jenin because that was probably going to be one of the more challenging and, inflamed places, you know, and that was better for somebody who had some more time because the situation was so charged that you could use a little time just to get accepted by the local community and stuff. And if you were only there for a week, by the time they got to know you, you left, what good is it, you know? So in light of the fact that I had 3 months, they were like, you should go to Jenin, because it's pretty intense there, and the longer you stay, the more people there will accept you and like you, and it'll be good. So I did. And I went there with a guy from New York City called Aaron, who was a very religious Jewish guy from New York City. And he had even, at points in his life, he was older than me, at points in his life had even been like Hasidic Jew, like really Orthodox, I guess, you know,
right.
With the special clothing and
the locks
that hang off their sideburns, and he was really Jewish and really proud Jewish, and I wanted to go with him because I thought what a beautiful thing that this guy, I mean, I can imagine what kind of, you know, vitriol he might have faced in his own community back home for having done this, but he just saw, this is not the Jewish people, this is not what we're about, and I want to go over there and do something about it and write about it.
Wow.
And I wanted to spend that experience with him. He only had a few weeks, but still, we did spend that time together. We went up to Jenin together, which isn't easy. I mean, it's hard to travel around the occupied territories, especially then. There was checkpoints all over the place. You know, I'm talking about Israeli army checkpoints. You know, I mean, movement was very restricted. I mean, it was like, it should have been like an hour and a half drive. Sometimes it would take like 12 hours to get from like Ramallah or Jerusalem to Jenin.
Right.
Just because there were so many closures. I mean, again, this is the height of the Intifada, so like everybody's on full alert.
Right.
Yeah. We left our training, and we bought phones. You had to get a phone, you know, so that to be useful, you had to have a cell phone.
Right.
So we got our phones and we took off to Jenin. And I remember that drive. We made it, but it took all day. And we had to avoid so many checkpoints. Like, you couldn't be a foreigner in the occupied territories. Like, we had snuck into the occupied territories, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, if there was a roadblock, you had to turn around and avoid it. Because it was like, a couple of Americans are going to Jenin? I don't think so.
Okay, so what are they going to do in that situation?
Like, at the very least, turn you around and maybe arrest you. You just had to avoid all contact with them when in transit. So, like, you weren't getting through the checkpoint. Palestinians probably eventually would. They're often not. I mean, you've heard the stories about how horrible the checkpoints are for Palestinians. But as a foreigner, you were simply not allowed in the occupied territories at that time because the Israeli army was, you know, in the middle of, like, a war operation and didn't want a bunch of American kids writing articles about what was happening.
Right. You know? So was there actual laws against you entering the occupied territories, or would it be just like,
well,
we're just going to fucking turn you back? Or, like... Like, as an American citizen, right, could you actually be, like, convicted of anything? I mean,
you would never be convicted of anything. They would just take that opportunity to send you a back
to
home.
To put your ass out of the country. Okay.
Home. They would, like, escort you onto an airplane. I've been to an airport.
Okay.
So, I mean, they just didn't want you in there. It was hard to get there. Anyway, we got to Jenin, and the city was under curfew, which in Palestine doesn't mean, like, be home at 8, honey, you know. Curfew means you're not allowed to leave the house. It's a communal lockdown, which is totally illegal under international law.
Okay.
So that kids aren't going to school, so that markets aren't opening, farmers can't get to their fields, shops can't open, you can't walk down the street to get water, all of this under pain of death.
Yeah.
You know, that if you're seen on the street...
You actually could be shot.
You could be shot. It's not to say you will be, but certainly it's happened many... many times.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a dangerous thing to be out on the streets, particularly as a Palestinian, during a time of curfew. And we knew that Jenin had already had tons of curfew since the Intifada started, like a lot, maybe like more days than not. So, you know, kids had essentially missed the school year, crops were rotting in the field, nobody could open their shops, like they'd have curfew for like 3 or 4 days.
How long
and then
they
lifted it for 2 hours so people could run out and buy food.
Okay.
This had been going on, you know, well, bearing in mind, this is only 6 months after the Jenin camp invasion that I described earlier, you know.
Yeah.
This was like a war zone, really. So that there were Israeli tanks patrolling the streets during curfews, and then maybe they'd pull out for a day or two. Or, as often as not, like I said, they'd have curfew for like 4 straight days where people didn't have food. And then they'd lift it for 2 or 3 hours and be like, all right, everybody, go get your food. Get ready for the next round.
Right.
You know, and that was their concession to international law, was letting you out of your house every 4 days to haul ass down to the store and buy food if you were lucky enough to have money because you couldn't work.
Right.
So we got there, and it was a pretty intimidating place, bro, I'll be honest with you. And the only people out on the streets were, like, the young kids, the Shabab, as they call them. Shabab it literally just means like young guys, like the boys or something like that, the fellas. But in the context of the Intifada, it meant like the kids who were out in the streets throwing rocks at Israeli tanks and stuff like that. And
hoodlums.
Well, perhaps, yeah. I mean, they did tend to come from tougher socioeconomic backgrounds. Like, you probably wouldn't see a doctor's kid out there doing it, you know?
Yeah.
But... you know, that they saw themselves as patriots and that they were making at least some symbolic protest against this illegal and very heavy-handed occupation of their city, you know. So, the city, I mean, like I said, this is 6 months after the Jenin camp invasion, which affected the whole city. The city was busted up badly. Let me describe the city a little bit. Now... the city was probably 45 or 50,000 people, surrounded by farm villages up in the northern West Bank. Attached to the city was Jenin refugee camp, Mukhaim Jenin. Mukhaim is refugee camp. They're all over the West Bank. They're all over the Middle East. Yeah.
Okay.
Sadly enough, all over the Middle East. And, you know, that they're attached. That it's, the camp is like another neighborhood of the city.
Okay.
There's not that big of a difference. I mean, there's a difference... socially, perhaps, but in terms of the physical geography of the city, I mean, the two things had grown together. So the city had experienced that invasion along with the camp, you know, 6 months prior. And, I'm sorry, 18 months prior. This was 2002, the Jenin camp invasion. I misspoke earlier. I said that the Jenin camp invasion was 6 months before I got there. It was 18 months before I got there.
Okay.
So the city was really devastating. There's bullet holes in all the walls. There's graffiti all over the place. The shops are all shut and shuttered. There's nobody on the street. That's a strange thing. In a medium-sized city of 60-some thousand people, you don't see anybody on the streets except for a couple ragtag kids. And that's really about it, because it was curfew the day we arrived. So we had to kind of walk in from the city limits, because the cabbie was like, yeah, this is as far as I go, you know, and that was like our eighth cabbie to get all the way from Jerusalem. But we had the phone numbers of the ISM group individuals that were already there in Jenin. We called them and said, yeah, we're in this big vacant lot, looks like the center of the city. They came and found us. They took us back to their apartment, which was an office, like in the center of the city. Well located. We could get anywhere in the city within like a 20-minute walk. And it was just a bunch of mattresses on the floor. I mean, it was real
Husker Du scene.
Yeah, that's indeed correct. It was not comfortable living by any means. Needless to say, like no hot water, you know, often no water at all because you had a tank on the roof and the trucks weren't always allowed to come fill it. We shared the building with a radio station and a couple other businesses. So we began to get acquainted with our fellow ISM volunteers, who were most, you know, a younger bunch of activists for the most part from America and Canada and to a degree Europe. And then they took us out. They said, well, it's curfew now. So during curfew, we wander the streets, making sure that if anybody is out on the streets, that they don't get shot or that they don't get bundled away in the back of an APC or whatever.
What's an APC?
Armored Personnel Carrier, okay. Which is like a tank without a turret.
Right. Kind of, you know. Paddy wagon.
Yeah, but like on a track, like a tank, you know, okay. It's like a military vehicle. Okay. So we thought, well, this is the ISM I've read about, you know, like nobody else going out on the streets, ISM going to walk the streets, you know. It was a pretty bold group, you know. It was a bold idea in the first place, I guess, to bring foreigners into the heart of the Intifada and tell them, all right, see what you can do, try to get in the way and make sure these kids don't get shot or whatever.
Right.
So we were out there that first night, wandering the streets. And that night, I remember a Black Hawk helicopter came into the city because tanks were patrolling, and we would kind of try to avoid them, but if we got in a position where they were going to ride by us and there was nothing we could do about it, we would just hold our arms up in the air in the international sign of, like, I'm not holding a gun or about to attack you or whatever.
And we're flag.
Visibly non-Palestinian people. They didn't want to get out of their armored vehicles. The Israeli soldiers probably didn't want to be there in the first place, you know.
Right.
So they would just slow down and then drive past. And so we were out there, and I remember that first night, there was a place called Stone Thrower's Alley, which, having been back to Jenin since the Intifada ended, is like the main business thoroughfare of the street, of the city, I'm sorry. And at the time, it was Stone Thrower's Alley, because there was nobody on the streets except for these, you know, adolescent and early teenage and stone-throwing kids that just kind of milled around the streets waiting for a tank to drive by, and then they'd all kind of hide behind the corners and then throw rocks at it and chase it and various acts of bravado, and obviously no tactical threat to the people inside the tank or anything, just throwing stones at a steel-plated tank. But
right.
So we were getting to know them throughout the day and the evening.
Just to interrupt, but this is still the first trip that you made.
Oh, yeah. This is the first trip. This is me, like, 8 hours into Jenin, or not even.
Okay.
Pretty intimidated.
Yeah, Jesus.
And the people that have been there, like, 2 months were still pretty intimidated, because the stone thrower kids had been so oddly socialized, if you can imagine their lives. As if you're a 10 or 12 year old kid in Jenin in 2003, you know, your coming of age has all taken place in pretty rough.
Within the context of this conflict.
Exactly, exactly. Right, right. And that your father was probably dead or in prison, and that your older brothers were probably dead or in prison, and that you had lived through the Jenin camp invasion, and that you might have lost loved ones in front of your eyes during the Jenin camp invasion.
Right.
And that every day since the Jenin camp invasion, these same guys that did it, the same guys that did it, that killed mom or whatever, have been gallivanting through your city streets and telling you to go inside.
Right.
If you're lucky, telling you to go inside, if not, taking a couple shots at you.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, they were an oddly socialized bunch, and it wasn't not a situation of immediate acceptance. They're a pretty tough bunch of kids, to be honest.
Yeah.
And this isn't Palestinians in general. This is like that stone thrower element, the kind of people whose folks let them out on the streets to go do this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying it's a certain element, you know. So that was pretty intimidating. They want to know where you're from. They want to know how you felt about the Jenin camp invasion. They want to know if you love Bush. And, you know, you go tell them, hey, I'm American. Oh, great. You know. So that led to a barrage of questions. But as days and weeks went by, became accepted by them. And, which is weird, trying to get the acceptance of a 12-year-old kid. You know, at home you'd be like, what the hell do I care what a 12-year-old kid thinks about me? But,
right.
You know,
right.
Your whole world's turned upside down, and it's their turf, and you have to get some level of acceptance before you can do your job effectively.
And this is within the Jenin camp?
Jenin camp and Jenin city itself.
Okay.
This first day was actually in the city.
Where were you actually sleeping?
Our lodgings were in the city itself, not in the camp.
Okay.
The camp at that time was devastated. I toured the camp during that time, and we did some actions in the camp during that first trip I was there. But I can't imagine that it would have been very practical for foreigners to live in the camp. See, the thing is that the way the occupation has unfolded, a lot of Palestinians, particularly in harder hit areas, more afflicted areas like Jenin camp, and I'm not saying most, but some Palestinians in those tough, tough areas have become pretty distrustful of outsiders with good reason.
Right.
Because the Israeli army has sent in undercover assassins posed as journalists or whatever, you know, and then they go on and kill somebody.
Right.
Things like that, you know. So there was a wall to break down there with some of the people, especially of like lower socioeconomic classes from the refugee camp and stuff, before they would trust you.
Okay.
But once they did, boy, you know, you had a friend for life. I mean, those some very real and good people over there, and we never blamed them for being initially distrustful at all. You know, if anything, we were always shocked by the degree to which we were accepted there. I mean, after all, we were Americans wandering through Jenin camp that we had just paid and diplomatically supported to be destroyed.
Right.
Okay, so my experience, and I'll try to do this fairly briefly, but the gist of my experiences there with ISM during the Intifada were that life there was horrifying for the people that lived there, you know, whether they lived in Jenin camp or the surrounding farm villages or the city of Jenin itself, you know, that their lives were completely controlled by the Israeli Defense Forces, that it was an illegal situation of communal lockdown, labeled curfews by the IDF, but it's not a curfew, it's a lockdown. And that, you know, people weren't allowed to leave their homes, that the school year went to waste, that crops went to waste, as I mentioned, businesses weren't allowed to open, and that there were frequent episodes of violence by these roving Israeli tanks and, to a lesser degree, Humvees and APCs that rolled through the city every day that there was a curfew.
These curfews apply to every person?
Every single person.
So it doesn't matter if you own a business or...
Absolutely not.
You work on a farm or whatever.
It doesn't matter
at
all.
You can't leave your house.
You cannot leave your house.
Okay.
Like, you would give birth in your living room if there was a hospital a kilometer away.
Okay.
And that this is obviously a horrifying thing for any group of people to go through. And this was their life before I got there, and this was their life after I left. I was only there for this 3-month window. And during this, we saw also episodes of real military violence against civilian people. We saw their IDF's frequent tactic of invading a house to use it. They would go in the middle of the night and break into a house and put all the Palestinian residents of that house or even that compound, maybe even like 30, 40 people, into one small bedroom and just tell them to stay there quietly, take away their cell phones and everything, and hoping that nobody else had heard them enter, they would use that house as an observation point with which to keep an eye on, like, the neighborhood in general, or maybe the neighbor was somebody that was wanted, so to speak, that they thought was a fighter, and they wanted to observe him or have a good launching point to arrest or to kill him. And in the course of doing this, they would trash the houses. Trash the houses, like, in a really malicious way, not just like, ooh, we accidentally knocked over the bookshelf
right.
in the course of our duties, but like, we're here to trash your house, you Arab piece of shit. you know, was the way that they conducted themselves, including graffiti and everything to that effect. And a lot of what we did, especially the first few weeks I was there, was after they would leave these houses, we would go in there and document, you know, the damage they had done to the house, the horrible things they had done to the people in the house.
Okay. That was part of your, like...
That was a big part of what ISM was doing. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Was these home occupations, as it were, that might last a day or two or three days, and were horrific for everybody involved. I mean, you're sitting there, maybe like granddad's got to, you know, use the bathroom in a bucket in front of his granddaughters, you know, in a room, a tiny little bedroom crowded with like 30 people for days on end, you know, and that we would interview the people afterwards, and that the treatment was almost always really disgustingly hateful, you know, the way that they had been treated by the IDF, and that the places had just been like trash, often even with like structural damage, not just like ruining everything in there. You wouldn't believe the degree to which these places were trashed, like everything turned over, broken, everything they could do to trash it, like so malicious, you know, not an accident.
Right.
And I saw this many, many times. So it showed the complete disregard for everyday Palestinians. It's like, hey, screw you, I could do your house for a couple of days to spy on your neighbor.
Yeah.
And in the course of it, because I happen to hate you or whatever,
take a shot,
I'm going to ruin everything. And there was examples of shit being smeared on cooking utensils and on walls and stuff. And we saw that with our bare eyes. And we interviewed the people that lived through that. And that wasn't even considered a big deal, because there was also people getting killed out in the streets. We saw, I remember within 2 weeks of getting there, and maybe even like the first week of getting there, there was a little kid that went around during curfew selling little cups of Arabic coffee out of a big bassoon of Arabic coffee, which is the way they do it over there. And he wasn't even a stone thrower, but one day a bunch of stone throwers came out, and even some men too, because they were also fed up with the curfew, and got to just kind of milling around the streets, and when a tank went by, they would either yell, or some of them would throw rocks or whatever. They started blasting off rounds from their big-ass tank-mounted machine gun, and shot this little coffee boy in the leg, and really turned his leg inside out, you know, it like hit him in the knee, and that was a gruesome wound, and this kid wasn't even doing anything. And he's a little boy. I mean, this kid was probably like 8 or 9 years old. And then there were, I guess, a couple other occasions where we saw live fire from IDF tanks. You know, not tank fire, but machine gun fire. And this is a big-ass machine gun. It's like an M50 or whatever, you know, with, like, bullets the size of, like, a hot dog or something like that. They would open up fire, maybe not necessarily trying to mow down everybody in the crowd, but, like, if a couple people got hit, that was all right, you know. And we saw that a couple times. We saw housing demolitions. We saw a lot of really, you know, horrible things, and to, you know, as a limited degree to which we could really help in any realistic way like that. But there were times that we blocked tanks and stood in front of them to give people time to get away and stuff like that, you know. But I bet from the, you know, almost 90 days that I spent in Jenin during that time, I would say they were on curfew, which is to say that lockdown, you know, at least 2/3 of that, you know, that the kids weren't going to school, etc. And that was just for living there, you know, having done nothing wrong. I mean, yeah, there was a conflict going on, but to treat all the civilians like that, all the people there, you know. And we did a lot of interviews with people that had just lived through such horrible experiences, and you know, their whole lives revolved around that. And a couple hours away in Tel Aviv, people were partying, you know, eating pizza, going to work, like it was no thing.
Yeah. So now let's get into when you were there the second time.
Alright, well, I went home from that trip, did some writing, did some speaking tours. I did a lot of writing while I was there, did some more when I went home. I wouldn't say I did speaking tours, actually. I just did speaking engagements within my local community there.
Yeah.
And
In Albuquerque,
yeah. And then got back into school. I had to graduate. I only had a few classes left. And, you know, life went on. I was still, you know, interested and active in these things. But I also maybe was experiencing some levels of PTSD or something similar to that in retrospect. I had a hard time, you know, leaving the house if I didn't really have to, you know, and I was broke and everything. It was a pretty tricky time. But anyway, that, you know, life improved and I got through that, and I guess I just felt weird being back in the States after going through that. I wanted to stay there, you know, like, I made great friends there. I had meaningful and eye-opening experiences there. I wanted to stay there, but that wasn't an option.
Right.
You can only get your 3-month visa. So anyway, I was back home. Life went on for a couple of years. All I wanted to do was go back to Palestine, but I couldn't get the money together. And so I came to Korea a couple of years ago for the first time with the express reason of saving money here. As we know, Korea is known for a place to come teach ESL for a year and save 10 grand or whatever.
Right.
So I did that, and then I went back to Palestine with my earnings from that first year in Korea. You know, this was years later. A lot had changed. This was, let's see, 5 years later. This was a much different trip. The Intifada had ended. The occupation was different because it was now a matter of surrounding the cities rather than being a day-to-day part of them. So you could walk around Jenin, the businesses were open, or any other city there, you know. Gaza being its own situation. Gaza is worse and just unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable that the world tolerates what's happening in Gaza. But not that it's not bad in the West Bank. But so it was a little more hands-off. It was more like a strangulation strategy at that point, because I think the Israeli government no longer wanted to handle the horrible publicity of daily casualties. You know, like, in my first time there during the Intifada, I would bet that there were at least 12 or 15 civilian deaths, and maybe a good bit more than that, because memory fades, during that brief 3-month period that I was there. And I'm talking about, like, little kids on their way home from school getting picked off. And that did happen, you know, while we were there. I'm not talking about fighters. We don't count them as civilians.
Right.
You take up arms. There's nothing wrong with that, maybe, but either way, you're not a civilian at that point.
Right.
So, strategies had changed. Things had cooled off to some degree. It was more of a strategy of strangulation, of not letting them take their crops to the nearest market, of not letting them certainly do any business with Israel in terms of selling their agriculture there and stuff like that. And, you know, that's their right. Of all the things they can do, that's their right. If they don't want to do business with the occupied territories, that's fine. But they don't have a right to be in the occupied territories. It's supposed to be two different entities, you know.
Right.
You trade with whoever you want, but get the hell out of the occupied territories, you know. So my second trip there, I went there. I had a hard time finding anything. ISM wasn't doing too much then, and I understand it's picking back up now. But at the time, going back there with ISM wasn't really an option for me. And the Intifada had ended. Another thing, you know. It had been defeated, sadly to say. You know, a lot of people died, tons were locked up. People were worn out. And so I decided I'll go back and teach ESL, English as a Second Language, which is the career I had fallen into, for free, because I had this money I'd saved in Korea. And I'll fund my own way. I didn't really ask for donations or anything. I wasn't really part of a community anymore at that point back home. So I did so. And it took a long time to find anything, because there's such a tight clamp down on them dealing with the outside world, you know, and that a lot of the groups had been smashed, and it was just hard to find a gig, even though I was willing to self-fund myself.
Right.
Finally, I got an email address from a friend of a woman who did community work, Palestinian woman who did community work in Jenin, who I hadn't met the first time around. And I emailed her, kind of at the end of my rope, just being like, hey, do you know of, like, community centers and stuff that would be glad to have free ESL classes? Because I've got the money, and all I want to do is come back to Jenin.
Right.
And she said, heck yes, come on over. And within, like, a day of our first email exchange, she sent me, like, a full schedule.
Nice.
Like, she just had to put the word out. Everybody was dying for it, you know?
Right.
All wanting to get educated and make up for the lost years of the Intifada and learn their English and study. So I said, all right, I'm coming, and I went. It was not as hard to get in the second time because things had cooled off, but I still had a pretty thorough cover story and everything like that.
Did you have to pose as a Christian nerd?
I did not. I posed as being interested in getting a master's degree in one of their universities in Israel.
Okay.
And got a full 3-month tourist visa. And right away, zipped over to, almost right away, I mean, I toured the West Bank for a few days, because when I was there, you couldn't. I had never been to Hebron, or what the Palestinians call Al-Khalil. I had never been to even the villages surrounding Jerusalem were hard to go to when I was there, you know. So I took about a week and cruised around the West Bank with a war photographer that I became buddies with over there. We were staying in the same hostel in Jerusalem. And that was fascinating because you couldn't believe that you could get on a bus in Jerusalem and go to Ramallah, which is in the occupied territories, and from there go to like Hebron or go to Nablus.
Huh.
And it was not that big of a deal.
Huh.
And the Israelis might even see it and be like, well, good luck. We think these people are crazy, but do whatever the hell you want. That was a different world to us. But it was 5 years later, and the uprising had ended, so things had cooled out a little bit. I wouldn't say they'd improved for the Palestinians, but they had changed. It was less of a war and more of a strangulation. But anyway, for me as an American, I could go about wherever the hell I wanted besides Gaza.
So what was the teaching like?
The teaching... So I get to Jenin, second time around, and I know people there this time. So I go over to my friend Abu Ali, a shopkeeper there, and I'm like, he couldn't believe to see me, you know, 5 years later.
Right.
No email exchange all these years. And I get situated, I get a hold of the woman who had put together the program for me. The teaching was fascinating. I had a class in a women's center. The camp had been largely rebuilt. I wouldn't say it was nice, but there was structures for people to live in.
Right.
So I had a class in Jenin camp at a women's center called Not to Forget Women's Center.
Yeah.
And that was just, you know, about like it sounds, a place for women to go and, you know, work around the issues they were facing as women in their community, you know, vis-a-vis the occupation and everything like that.
Right.
And I taught an English class there twice a week, and I taught at a language center that was attached to something like a junior college. You know, the kids could go to this after their regular classes at their little junior college.
Right.
They could go to this language center for extra training, and they were thrilled to have a free American teacher, you know, and there were several other centers like that throughout the city that I volunteered at. So I ended up having the point where I had, you know, between 2 or 3 and 4 and 5 hours of ESL teaching every day, mostly with like young adult, like university age students, but also with like older women at the center in the camp. And I lived with a family in the camp. And,
what was that like?
They were great people. I mean, this woman worked at the Not to Forget Center, at the Women's Center.
Okay.
So they were like, hey, if you want to take this American guy in for a few months, he'll probably, you know, not be any trouble. He's been here before. Seems to be an alright guy. They didn't know me from Adam, really. These people I stayed with didn't speak any English, but they were really nice and welcoming. You know, I ate my meals with them. They had a very humble house there in the Jenin camp. I chilled with the family. There was an almost total language barrier, but they were great people. They were very welcoming. They were really poor.
I have to ask, did you know very much Arabic at this point in time? Or?
Very little, very little. And I'm not being humble, like, really, not much at all. So, yeah, I mean, I lived with these people. They were really nice to me. They had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 little kids. Well, not all that little, I guess, but they had 4 kids from, like, probably age 13 to, like, 6. They lived in very humble circumstances there in Jenin camp. Their previous house had been demolished during the invasion, during the massacre, whatever you want to call it, a couple of years prior, the one I talked about earlier.
Right.
They had all lived through that, and barely. They had all lost people they knew in that. And he sold vegetables in the market in Jenin for like 12 or 14 hours a day, and he usually made like, he'd make between like 6 and 14 or 15 bucks a day for that long ass day. And, you know, it's not that cheap there because the prices are affected by the Israeli economy because of the occupation.
Right.
You know, it's like third world incomes in a almost upper tier second world economy, you know. So they didn't have, you know, like nice food or nice stuff at all, you know, like they didn't have a phone, They had to wear the same clothes almost every day. I mean, they were, like, poor, like you might see in parts of South Asia or Africa, but in that unnatural poverty that is visited upon Palestine, you know, right. In which you'd be doing well if you were left alone, but circumstances have made you poor as hell. They were really poor. Well, I left there having finished my visa and unfortunately having to leave because things were going well, our classes were going well. I went back to the States and within, you know, like 3 weeks I was here in Busan. I was flat broke. Okay. I had spent, you know, all my money either in the lead up to that trip or on the trip itself. So I came back here with like $90 in my pocket. Okay. And I've been here since. That was almost 2 years ago and I'm leaving in 3 months. And I hope to end up back in Palestine in the next, I don't know when, no specific timeline, but hopefully in certainly less than a year, I hope to be back there again, and maybe to find a way to be able to stay longer, not these little 3 month bites, but to really be able to go there and stay for a while. They're great people over there. They get a bad rap in the media. I mean, they're not a bunch of Al-Qaeda jihadists running around. They're just normal folks. I mean, they're just trying to do their thing, you know.
What's like one of the better media outlets to go as far as this issue is concerned, you know?
Yeah, great question. Well, we mentioned Democracy Now! Earlier. They do a good job with it, democracynow.org. ISM's website is palsolidarity.org, palsolidarity.org. That's a really good website, and I was just on there today and seeing that they definitely have actions going on over there. I think that from when I was there a few years ago when ISM wasn't really happening, I think now it is again. And I think people might find that they were able to do some really meaningful and eye-opening work over there, even if you just have a couple weeks. And that website's got a lot of updates on demonstrations that people are doing over there in conjunction with ISM, Palestinian farmers, etc., that have been, you know, eviscerated by the wall. And it's also got instructions on how you can go about actually doing that, going there yourself, or donating money, or a ton of other media resources. There's a website called Electronic Intifada that I don't really use, but I've heard is really good. Electronic Intifada.
Maybe just always Z Magazine.
Z Magazine's good, yeah. And I would recommend the palsolidarity.org especially. That's a good website. And now, you know, since the Intifada began, I think there was a lull where everybody was just like, holy smokes, that was insane.
Right.
Wow, that was rough. Now a couple of years have passed, there's getting to be a lot of really good nonviolent protests over there. Just straight up like marching on nonviolently on issues about the wall, about people being separated from their farmland, about settlements expanding their land and stealing more land. So there's a lot of exciting stuff going on over there in terms of nonviolent resistance, and it's more important now than ever.
And thus ends part two of our interview with Ben. We thank Ben for coming on the show and allowing me to invade his apartment for an evening, and all of his encyclopedic and eloquent insights into this very important and consequential situation going on over in Palestine. So thanks again, Ben, and dear listener, thank you so much for tuning in, and we will see you next time. Hope you enjoyed the show. Good night.